This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Melbourne Convention and Exhibition Centre for tonight's very special Wheeler Centre event. I'm Michael Williams. I'm the director of the Wheeler Centre, and I am so thrilled to be part of presenting to you tonight's conversation between Kerry O'Brien and Paul Keating. In fact, I'm going to milk it. Give us a bit of noise. I would like to take a moment to acknowledge that we're on the traditional lands of the Kulin Nations and pay my respects to their elders past and present and the elders of any other communities that might be with us today. Remembering the Kulin Nations and talking about the Wurundjeri people and the Boonwurrung people is an acknowledgement that's not just about a recitation at the start of a public event. It's about respect and it's about remembering. It's about acknowledging that the political and moral implications of invasion remain unresolved to this day, and it's all of our responsibility to make that part of the public conversation that we take part in. And that is, of course, a reminder that neither of our guests tonight need to receive. They've both contributed so much to public life. The Wheeler Centre exists and proudly exists to be a home for public conversation. We believe all civil society, all good communities rely on a gathering point where the citizens can come together and talk about ideas bigger than themselves, things more important than their day-to-day. And I have to say, in the green room backstage just then, I got a masterclass of that in just a few moments, including the declaration that music is the most superior art form. I wanted to argue, but I was powerless in the gaze of the man I was talking to. Both author and subject of the book tonight will be available for signing after the event. I'll come out afterwards just to talk you through the logistics of that. But enough from me. I'd ask you to give a very big, very loud Melbourne welcome to two men who have done more for public conversation and more for public intellectual life in this country than many of us could hope to achieve in a lifetime. Ladies and gentlemen, Paul Keating and Kerry O'Brien.
Paul, I'm a little bit embarrassed. I'm sure at least some of them are here for you too.
Well, it always pays to be at a show less with a popular guy.
We did the Opera House on Tuesday night and now this, and I'm beginning to understand what reflected glory means. So, Paul, thank you on behalf of everyone here for this opportunity tonight. Michael talked about a two-minute masterclass. We get a 90-minute masterclass. And thank you for turning out so enthusiastically. There's an obvious question to start with, and it's a question that I hear all the time, and that is, why, of all the modern leaders, are you the one who has never done the autobiography?
Well, I gave the answer the other night, Kerry, so I can't say it's original, but I always reckon if you're any good, someone else will write about you, you know? I mean, writing your own story is a bit pathetic. A bit. I mean, if you've got to get down and write your own story, you know.
Well,
give us a break. Give us a break.
So I let that one through.
And the other thing is, you know, it's so subjective. Biographies are so, autobiographies are so subjective, you know. They have to be because you see it from a certain direction, you know. And so therefore, this book is more real because I'm getting prodded by a professional prodder.
He did say at one point, and it's not so much a reflection, it wasn't a compliment to me, it was simply a comment really about the way we did it. What he said was that that there are things we've covered through this process, through our many conversations, that he would not have thought to address himself. So that's one, I guess, tick for doing it this way. But Paul, I suspect there's a little more to it, and having seen some of the kind of not perfectionist approach that you take, because you said to me at one point in our conversations that we can pursue the ideal, but to try to attain it is a kind of road to madness. But in that search for perfection, I suspect if you put pen to paper, you might never finish the autobiography.
Yeah, and you've got to ask yourself what the point of it is, you know. I mean, the great story, there is a great story here, the reformation of Australia, you know, because people have forgotten how poor the country was at the end of the 70s, you know. Our terms of trade, the value of the things we sold compared to the value of the things we bought, started to turn down about the time Menzies retired in the middle 60s. So for 20 years, the Holt government, the Gorton government, the McMahon government, the Whitlam government, the Fraser government, ignored the underlying problems of Australia, you know, ignored the fundamental problems. And so we were an old industrial museum by 1982, 83.
I do remember one grand stroke of Gough's, which was somewhat characteristic of him, and that was the 25% tariff cut. Yeah, I think that was acknowledging a fundamental problem, it didn't quite work.
Because you know all the problems. See, what I sought to do as treasurer was to come to Australia with a new political philosophy, a new approach to Australia. That instead of good politics being about tricky play running up to elections, the tax cuts are unaffordable, all this sort of stuff, I wanted to turn good policy into good politics. And this, in a way, this had never happened in Australia. And to turn good policy into good politics, you had to educate the public, speak up to the public, involve them in a big national conversation, and believing, as I always did, that the public are conscientious at heart, you would engage them in the conversation. Yeah, you would engage them in the conversation, and so you would get a reward for good policy, not a cross. And so, therefore, turning the cynical political culture on its head. And once we're able to do that, in a sense, getting a roll on, and then burning up the capital as we went, burning up the political capital, not being safe, not being tricky, just blasting through, making the changes. So that's why Australia has been the best performing economy for the last 25 years in the world. That's why out here, real wages growth is 46 or 47% since 1991. That's after inflation. And why disposable incomes, that's real wages growth plus falling prices, is 60% more than it was in 1983. That's why Melbourne's growing. That's why we've got a restaurant culture. That's why we have a service culture, because the place is richer.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to take you back a little bit to when you first came to the Parliament. And it surprised me a little bit when you said this at the time. You were this cocky young guy, full of ambition. I think the swagger probably would have been pretty pronounced as you made your way through Young Labor, all those state conferences, those noisy state conferences, and the left and the right ripping each other to shreds. Yeah. And you arrived in the Parliament, and what you were talking about, I think, that for one brief moment in time, you were just a little bit overwhelmed. What you said to me was that you'd go into these caucus committee meetings and you were getting to know your colleagues, and one of the first things that hit you was just how much you did not know.
Yeah, just how many clever people were sitting around, you know. And so I thought, I've got a very big learning curve here to climb up, you know. But the thing about the Labor Party, though, it always had this huge confusion between ends and means. You know, and it was ideologically confused through the 50s and the 60s and the 70s.
So when you say the confusion between ends and means, what exactly do you mean?
Well, we all wanted higher levels of economic growth, higher levels of employment growth, higher levels of real incomes, higher levels of support in old age, higher levels of support of quality in health, in education, etc. And the Hawke and Keating governments, that remained, of course, the Holy Grail. But the approach was different. We were never trying to run a a command economy of any kind. We were not trying to, you know, trying to run prosperity out of the Commonwealth budget. We were not trying to produce the social nirvana out of a piece of legislation. Rather, we wanted to employ the markets, to bring in the markets to make the whole economic pie larger and lift Commonwealth revenue, and then through policies of distribution. You know, when I give an example, when I became treasurer, 3 kids in 10 completed year 12. When Bob and I had finished, and I finished in 96, it was 9 in 10. Trebled them. So then we trebled university places. You can't do that out of a country that's poorer. You can't do that without a budget which has got real revenue, real surges of revenue. So the Labor Party had sort of, you know, the Labor Party had never kicked the habit from the years of post-war reconstruction under Chifley, you know, that we could actually order the economy out of the Commonwealth budget. So when I became Treasurer, everything was on the cabinet table. The exchange rate, interest rates, wages, prices through tariffs, and most of the microeconomy. By the time I left, it was all off. Exchange rates now set in the market. Interest rates are set by the Reserve Bank and in the market. You know, wages are set in an enterprise bargaining system. And Australia's now working. It works like a Swiss watch, you know. I mean, when our competitiveness goes down, the exchange rate falls for us, you know. When our competitors need, when things are good, our wages system takes wages up under enterprise bargaining. When they get a bit poorer, it comes down like it's doing now. So you've got these nice automatic stabilisers working now.
And yet, you know, we've gone through a situation. We were virtually the only country that retained a relatively stable economic base after the global financial crisis in 2008, and yet we were a country that was walking around almost with our head in our hands. We were so anxious, and Glenn Stevens would go overseas and say, and eventually he was saying it at home, I don't understand it. Yeah. Don't people understand how lucky we are? Yeah. You know, how safe we are compared to everybody else.
Because all the gadgets were working. All the gadgets that I had my hands on in the early 80s were working. Like the exchange rate went from 80 cents American to 48 in 2007. 48 cents. In other words, as the world went down, the exchange rate lifted the Australian dollar value of our exports, right? Protecting us from a recession, you know? As the wages system, instead of seeing the kind of distortions we used to have, the wages system held up. And so look at it now, the exchange rate's now, the mining boom is over. So the exchange rate's gone down from dollar for dollar US to now what, 73 cents. So of course, you know, you sell $100 million of iron ore, American, you get back $130 million Australian dollars. So, you know, the thing is, this is why, you see, taking the Labor Party through a process of education, you know, knocking off all the old nonsense about centrally planned economies and socialism, you know.
Well, just talk about that, because it's probably fair to say, isn't it, that you had bigger fights, bigger challenges with that message and with those reforms inside your own party than you did with the broader Australian electorate, which doesn't mean it was a doddle with the rest of us.
Yeah.
But is that true?
Oh, yeah. Of course, the Labor Party believed in all the wrong things. They believed in fixed exchange rates. They believe in government-set interest rates. They believe in wages at the centralised wages before the commission. I mean, Bob loved the commission. All these guys in the unions loved the commission, right? Yeah, I put the commission to death. I shot it. Bang. You know.
And up it sprang again.
Yeah, yeah.
In a different form.
So the point is, you see, it believed in all the wrong thing. This is one of the challenges that Malcolm Turnbull's got at the moment. He's got this dreadful pre-Copernican obscurantist right-wing party.
All right.
Right. And he's got to try and
Say that quickly.
He's got to try and shift it to some point of moderation in the centre. The question is, will they let him, and will he get there? I had to do the same.
Well, he'd be able to, whatever the polls are high.
Yeah, you would think. Yeah, but the polls are not everything. I mean, there's shellbacks under every rock. You know, you lift a rock and they're either under it or they've been there.
Just go back to where we were talking about the anxiety in Australia, even though there was little to be anxious about, and there was that big stimulus package of the Rudd government and so on.
Yeah.
And it was working out in the electorate, but the electorate didn't seem to realise it. I mean, was that fundamentally, was that a failure of communication? You were the great communications king in the politics of your day. That must surely have been a failure of communication.
Well, I think it was, basically. I think, look, you know, Kevin Rudd and Wayne Swan pull the right fiscal lever. I mean, it's very hard to say to a community, by the way, you would have been massacred on the way through, like the Americans were, like the Europeans were, and we saved you from the massacre. And the crowd say, because they're hard markets, oh, sure you did, right? So what you've got to do is explain to them that they had a flogging coming and that you have taken the whip away, you know. But that requires chat. Talk.
Yeah.
They're... But, I mean, the end result was fantastic for us. We just sailed straight through, no recession. No recession. Biggest recession since 1933.
Now, Ken Henry, who was in the thick of it in your day, said that he learnt, a lesson that he learnt from the Hawke Keating government's reaction to that recession, to your recession, was to spend big and spend fast.
That's right.
And that, in fact... And I think you have subsequently acknowledged that you wished.
Ken was in my office in those days, yeah. And we did this thing called the One Nation package in early 92, I did, to try and pull the economy out, which we did. 2 years later, we had the economy growing at 5%. It actually worked. But a lot of the public, like, for instance, I put the standard gauge railway through from Perth to Melbourne, which had never been there before. You used to have to change bogies in South Australia. But it took 4 or 5 years to do, so the crisis was over by the time we got it done. Although we did do cash payments to,
but that went. That came and went, didn't it?
But that came and went. It wasn't big enough, you know. So Ken was right. The thing to do was to give it a big hit with a big amount of money, which is what Rudd and Swan did.
Which the opposition then did their level best to turn into a negative.
Yeah.
And to a significant degree, they succeeded.
Well, Joe Hockey, you know, said, you know, this was Labor's spending, spendthrift, debt and deficits, you know. Poor old Srek. Well, he's gone. He's gone. Srek's just left.
But they did succeed in leaving on the Labor brand that sort of old... That old line that Labor in the end was spenders and that Labor couldn't really manage an economy.
Yeah. Well, that was to our fault, because that should never have happened, because the biggest reductions in Commonwealth spending ever, the first surpluses in the history of the Commonwealth government, were produced by me and Peter Walsh for 4 consecutive years, where we had outlays, Commonwealth spending growing less than the inflation rate. I mean, no one has ever done what we did in 1986, 1987, 88, 89, and coming into 1990. And, you know, it would have been better if the Labor Party had said all this stuff, you know, and you take the Libs on. I mean, the Libs have got, you know, poor old Abbott and Hockey, you know. I mean, Abbott arrived when I was Prime Minister, of course, you know. And, of course, he's got the big eyes to call him Wingnut, you know. And whenever he'd get up to ask a question, I'd always go to my crowd like this, you know. just to unnerve him. But to be beaten by Abbott is an affront to one's professionalism, really.
Well, he's gone. He's gone. And I'm very conscious. I'm going to make an assumption. I hope not an arrogant assumption that most of you, given that you're here to hear this man, probably saw the four-part ABC interview series. So I don't want to spend the night just going back all over the same stuff and have you feeling that you've just got an echo of the series. So I'm going to jump around a bit. You talk about Abbott going, which also means that Turnbull's finally arrived.
Yeah.
So let's go to the Republic. It all started with you.
Yeah.
You got up the hill a fair way, to some degree, with his help.
Yeah, I appointed him to do the report. Yeah.
And the reason you appointed him was to give it the sense of a bipartisan committee coming up with, fundamentally, a conservative
model.
Republican model.
True.
And you did that to make it easier for John Howard to accept it.
I did.
But he didn't.
He didn't accept it. Now, I had on that committee, I had Nick Greiner, I had Maurice Payne, the current Defence Minister. It was chaired by Malcolm Turnbull. And I had some other people like Mary Costakides, who was on SBS, etc. And I wanted to adopt a model for a republic that the Liberal Party could agree to. Because in a national referendum, if you don't have both major parties going for it, you're not going to win, right? So it's a Pyrrhic victory to do your own thing and lose. No point in that. And I just thought it was, until a Prime Minister picks up the republic, it'll never happen. You know, it's not going to happen out of the Republican movement. It's not going to happen by good intentions. It's going to happen by executive action, you know. And so it was a great disappointment to me that Howard, with his tricky referendum question, you know, went out of his way to defeat it, you know. Because, we said in our interview in Sydney, Kerry, you know, I always thought Australia could be a great country. But no great country ever had the monarch of another country as their head of state. Yeah. And so we had to, I mean, no great country can be a derivative society. We had all that derivativeness we had to turn off, and of course part of that had to be a true basis of reconciliation with the Indigenous, you know, to be us, to be proudly us, to represent all we created here. We have to have our head of state, who is one of us, and we've got to come to terms with the original colonial sin, the dispossession. And I wanted to do that. I tried that through the Native Title Act, through reconciliation and the Republic. And only when we get to these things will we ever really blossom. You know, I mean, what the Republic will do for Australia, you know, the Chinese have a word for the blood energy, the qi, the blood energy. What the Republic will do for Australia is increase the blood energy of the country, you know, give us a sense of ourselves and the energy of ourselves, the affirmation of who we are and what we are.
And yet, Paul, What is the evidence that this is in the hearts and minds of Australians as an important part of us and what we should be? Because after the defeat of the referendum, it was like the Republican issue disappeared, and it wasn't like there were no Republicans in the Liberal Party behind John Howard. His own deputy was a Republican, but it went nowhere, and there was a brief flutter. Just a couple of months ago, but there has been no cry for it ever since.
Well, no one would take it up. Kevin Rudd didn't take it up. Gillard wouldn't take it up. And, of course, Abbott, you know, was running back to Whitehall giving Prince Philip a knighthood. I mean, what chance have we had? So, therefore, you really need you've got to have a Prime Minister that understands its central importance to our personality as a nation, you know? And therefore, I think your point is, if it's not coming out of the community broadly,
I mean,
change
can happen from leadership at the top. It can also happen in response to a groundswell.
Yeah, that's true.
But there hasn't been one.
But a bit of leadership wouldn't go astray, would it? A bit of leadership wouldn't go astray. So, you know, So I think, you know, and I'm, you know, it may be, you know, in the balance of this term, Malcolm Turnbull wouldn't have the opportunity of doing this, particularly with his party the way it is, and who knows what the next election result will turn up. But, you know, Bob Hawke used to say to me, oh, look, you know, we ought to think about a republic when the Queen dies. I said, well, that makes us a pretty strong side, doesn't it? You know, wait till the old lady falls out of the chair, and then we'll say, that's ours. How weak is that?
We talked previously about where the Queen really stood in all of this, and you have said that she would not have been fussed at all if we had gone ahead and become a republic.
Well, she might have been fussed, but look, Prince Charles let the cat out of the bag when he came in 1994, I think it was.
Getting close.
And he said he understood Australia was getting on. Australia was maturing, he said, and he understood we were getting on with our symbols and our constitutional debate. You know, in other words, wink and wink, you wink, wink, you know, maybe it's time, you know. And I said to the Queen when I saw her at Balmoral, I said, you know, when you return to Australia as Queen of Great Britain and not the pretend Queen of Australia, the country will love you. But I said, now, where we are now, we have to make the break. And she famously said, I met her in Queen Victoria's favourite sitting room, which is in Balmoral, had the green and blue tartan carpet and all the faded furniture. If you're going to be a true aristocrat, always has faded furniture and, and frayed carpets. Anyway, so she said, so after that, after I told her with all the love I could put together that we didn't need her anymore, she said, I think I could do with a stiff drink. And I said, well, why don't we make that too?
And while we're still on the Queen, how many times did you have to correct her on the history of the dinner settings and the candelabras?
Oh, yeah. Well, I had a couple of run-ins with her over the silver. When we went across the English Channel on the Britannia on the 50th anniversary of D-Day, and there's Bill Clinton and Mitterrand and Queen, myself, anyway, they've got all the silver gilt out there. And I've got her in a conversation. And her private secretary comes across and says, how's everything going, ma'am? And she said, well, as a matter of fact, she said, I think the Prime Minister's trying to get away with my silver. So anyway, I said, well, look, these things, of course, were not, these were made by Benjamin Smith and Digby Scott. She said, oh, no, Paul Storr. I said, look, you should put me on a handicap when it comes to this stuff. She said, oh, no. So she called him over, Fellows. She said, Fellows, her private secretary, Fellows, I want you to turn these over and find the hallmarks, right? So Fellows has got to take the flowers out, lift the things up. And of course, there they were, BSDS, Benjamin Smith and Digby Scott, you know. I said, now, do I get one as a consolation prize?
In fact, that was the second time, I think. Wasn't the first time in the lodge in when the lodge. Bob was Prime Minister and you were there as a...
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right. We'd had a run over the target earlier. Yeah.
And you won that one too.
I won that one too. And, you know, I had Diana sitting next to me on one occasion, and there was a... In Connoisseur magazine in the 60s, and I used to collect this stuff, called Silver of Althorp, her family home. They had a great silver collection. Well, first of all, she was really cheered up. I knew about Althorp and the silver collection. And then she and I had a discussion about the silver, you know, as you do.
as any Labor minister would do. Yeah,
of course, that's right. Yeah. And of course, for Bob, it could have been sardine cans, you know. Thank you.
Since you've raised that trip with Mitterrand, and this was the 50th anniversary of Mitterrand and Clinton, you actually had a meeting then with Mitterrand.
Oh yeah,
in the palace.
He was a great guy, Mitterrand. He was full of fun. He just loved our policy. He loved the Republic. He loved the native title. He loved all the social programs.
What a pity he wasn't an Australian voter.
Yeah, yeah. And I said to him, I said, Monsieur le Président, this is like a piece of Dufour wallpaper. Dufour was the people who published the wallpaper around 1800, and they'd have the palm trees, and they'd have the natives, and they'd have the tricolour, you know. And I said, the policy is like a piece of Dufour wallpaper, you know. Anyway, lovely. He said, anyway, let me show you the... He said, I understand you're interested in the architecture and the furniture, and you know all about the Aliso, so let's go through and have a look. So he said, so he took me around, and he said, the first room he took me to was the Pompidou room, which had plastic furniture. And he said, that Pompidou, his taste was in his mouth. He said, taste was in his mouth. And finally, he takes me in for coffee in the silver room, where Bonaparte had abdicated. In the silver room, the cornices are not gilded, there in silver, and all of the accoutrements to the decoration are in silver, not gold, right? It's called the silver room. So he gets the table out that Bonaparte has signed the abdication on, and we're having the coffee on the table, right? Anyway, Bill Clinton's in town because we've just come across the English Channel, and we're about to do a press conference with Bill Clinton 40 minutes later. And they said, Monsieur le Président, you have the press conference and you haven't had a shave. So he said, get me the electric razor. So he's in the silver room in the mirror, giving himself a shave to do the press conference. Yeah, he's a fun guy.
This discussion can go in so many different directions, because every time he mentions a name, I think of another chapter. So we'll be all over the place, but it's going to be fun. Clinton. You got to know Clinton pretty well, I think, in that process where you were trying to get APEC up as a leaders' forum as opposed to a ministerial forum. Yeah. Bob Hawke got a tick for starting the ministerial forum in the Asia Pacific, and that was an important first step. But you then wanted to take it to another level. And that started when George Herbert Bush arrived in Australia expecting to meet Bob Hawke. I'm just exaggerating slightly, and the door to Kirribilli House opens and it's actually Paul Keating saying, come on in, George.
That's it, yeah.
You could have played it safe. You could have had a very straightforward meeting and shaken hands and had the picture opportunities and sent him on his way. But you said, bugger this, I want to talk to you about this new idea I've got.
Yeah, I did, yeah. Yeah, you see, the week before I became Prime Minister, the Soviet Union was dissolved. The week before. So the Cold War...
And you took that as an omen.
Well, I took it as a bit of a signal, that the sort of scarifying bipolarity of the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union had been switched off, like a couple of magnets just switched off. And so there was this great opportunity for what I call open regionalism. So countries like China, which would never have been in a strategic body with a country like Japan or the United States, or a country like Indonesia, which had led the non-aligned movement all through the Cold War, I could see the possibilities of sweeping up Indonesia, Southeast Asia, China, Japan and the United States and Australia, and putting them into a pan-Pacific piece of political architecture. And so I thought, I got the American president in town. He was coming basically to have a game of golf with Bob. That was what it was all about, a bit of chat, but fundamentally a game of golf. So I thought, well, I've got this guy, if I can get him in a headlock and interest him in the idea, he just might go for it, you know? Anyway,
Your offsider, Ashton Calvert, who I think had only come across to work for you as your foreign policy advisor days before, he described this in Paul Kelly's book, March of Patriots, that Keating, he said, was in that meeting shameless and compelling.
Well, I thought, it's a funny, you know, in the Pacific until then, US policy in the Pacific had been run by the Navy out of Honolulu. It was never run really by the State Department or the White House. And what I was trying to do was yank the Americans back into East Asia and engaging them. And I could see the rise of China coming, the growth of countries like Indonesia. And I wanted to get Australia. See, before I turned up, Kerry, the Australian Prime Minister only ever went to two things. The British Commonwealth Government meeting, which was one of the great non-meetings of the world, right? And the South Pacific Forum. Now, I love the South Pacific Forum, and I love the Pacific Islands. And that was real. But that was all we ever did. That's the only places we ever did. We never sat with the great powers, ever.
I mean, Shogun, the Commonwealth heads of government, did do one substantial thing. They were very much...
They broke apartheid.
Yes.
Yeah, they broke apartheid both in Rhodesia and in South... That's true. But Australia's vital interests were never in Africa. Australia's vital interests were in the East Asian hemisphere. And it wouldn't matter... I mean, it did matter. In fact, I was involved in setting up the economic sanctions on South Africa. And Nelson Mandela, you know, gave me the big bear hug years later for doing it, you know. But Bob led that in Chogram with other people, you know, and Malcolm Fraser before him, you know, in Rhodesia. But Australia's vital interests are here. They're in the East Asian hemisphere. And what I wanted to do when the Cold War finished, I saw the opportunity of us knitting together this body, you know. And if you get a choice of sitting at an important meeting or a non-important meeting, you'll always take the important meeting, won't you? Yeah. So you saw
Suharto as... I mean, Bush wasn't overwhelming in his response. He didn't rule it out.
No.
He said, you work on it. You work on it and see what happens. You go to Suharto because you saw him as the key.
Yeah.
You get him interested. You then whip across to Japan.
Yeah.
You get them interested and then you go to China. So this was a process, and I think Australia, although it was reported to a degree, it was kind of background, wasn't it, for a long time? It wasn't front and centre.
It wasn't front and centre, no, because, you know, I mean, it's not the sort of a sexy issue for the, you know, about, you know, daily life, etc. here. But Miyazawa, who was the Prime Minister of Japan, for many years he'd been Economics Minister of Japan, Finance Minister. And I used to see him at IMF meetings, you know. And the Americans used to treat the Japanese appallingly and Miyazawa appallingly. And I'd go to dinner with him of a night in Washington, and, you know. Anyway, I built a real friendship with Miyazawa. When he became Prime Minister, I opened up this idea with him. And he said, if you can get Suharto, I'll come with you. And so the key was getting the big block of Indonesia in there. And Suharto, of course, had this enormous policy ambition and ability. So I got Suharto, then I got Miyazawa, and then I had to get Lee Peng, you know. And that was a big event, getting him, the Chinese Premier.
Mm. So in the meantime, George Bush loses to Clinton. You've then got to start again with the Americans.
Yeah.
But you essentially... without exaggeration, I think, this is pretty well documented, you delivered all these others to Clinton, but he was still somewhat resistant.
Yeah, because he'd won the election on an attack on George Herbert Bush over the first Iraq war, and he had this slogan, it's the economy, stupid, and he won the election. So he said to me, I don't want to be 8 months later developing a strategic body with you. I've attacked them for... not worrying about the domestic economy. Here I am 8 months later, you're smooth talker, you're talking me into this body. So he said, look, I'll tell you this.
That'd be a compliment for Slick Willie to call somebody else a smooth talker.
Yeah, anyway, he and I got on well. He said, look, I'll think about this. If you can make it look like a trade body, I'll think about it, right? So anyway, we had these phone calls and things. So we decided we'd perhaps make it look like a trade body, though it was, of course, a strategic body. And we'd have the first meeting in Seattle to look across the Pacific for jobs. That was the pitch, right? And so Seattle was the home of Boeing and Microsoft, and Bill Gates turned up, and And so we had the first meeting there, and we got it up. And of course, Australia's been at that big seat ever since, 20 years now.
So go forward to the next one, Bogor. This was the second APEC meeting, and it was hosted by Suharto. I'll come to the serious side of that in a minute, but Clinton, you describe as arriving at that sort of looking wild-eyed and bloodshot, but he particularly wanted to have a discussion with you, not about Bogor, not about free trade, not about the region. He wanted to talk to you about how you had pushed the Conservative Party in Australia to the right and occupied the centre. Could he do that to the Republicans?
Yeah, well, he'd just been beaten by... That week, he'd been beaten by Newt Gingrich in the Contract with America election, the mid-term congressional election, and the Republicans won big time, right? And so he wanted to know how we had pushed the Liberal Party to the right and how we had Bob and I had occupied the centre and how... What were the lessons in this for him? How could he push them? And broadly, he followed our rule book, and he did succeed in pushing Gingrich and the guys to the right subsequently, and he won, of course, won the next presidential election 2 years later. So it was and he arrived. He'd been running all over the United States for the previous month, and he just lost. The election was held on the Wednesday, I think, or Tuesday, and he turns up on the Thursday or the Friday in Indonesia. You know, it was a very nice thing for him to do. He's funny, though. Mahathir was giving Suharto grief at the meeting. You know, I don't like that Mahathir, you know. anyway, so we're standing...
I think he knew that.
We're standing, Bill and I are standing at the urinal of all places, and he said...
As you do.
Paul, he said, you know what we're going to do with that, Mahathir? We're going to screw this guy. We're going to screw this guy. We're going to screw this guy, he said.
And did you?
Yeah, we did.
How?
Oh, just by knocking off all his amendments. He wanted addendums to the communique. And I said to Suharto, don't you weaken? Because Suharto was chairing it, you know. So Suharto just sat there and nailed him as we went. It was fantastic.
I was particularly struck when Paul was describing the process at Bogor because Australia had done the draft of what was the centrepiece of Bogor, but in Suharto's name. I mean, Suharto was the host. He presented the initiative for free trade in the region, right?
Yeah, true.
So take up the story.
Well, Suharto was a really big... He's got a very bad name in Australia, Suharto, but he was very soft on Australia. He liked us, and he had, of course, huge... executive ability and a big vision. So he could see, I mean, here he was for sort of 30 years running Indonesia and the non-aligned movement. All of a sudden the neighbour, me, has got him meeting the United States president, you know, sitting down at an APEC meeting, right? So I got him to host the second meeting and I said, we've got to have something to do. So we developed what's called now called the Bogor Free Trade Agenda, which was written in my office in Canberra with Alan Gingell, my former foreign policy and economic advisors. And then Suharto presented this as his policy. And of course, we're now coming back to it now because the importance of APEC is that now the Americans are just concluding the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, which excludes China, is designed to exclude China. The only way we're going to get a region-wide, completely open trade agreement is really through APEC. So the Bogor Declaration is going to come up again now. It's going to become more important again now, 20 years later. And so that all happened. That's, again, another gift of Australian foreign policy. You know, we can do this stuff.
What struck me as you were describing that process was the way you were virtually moving from delegation to delegation as amendments were going on. And this can sound like watching grass grow, watching people writing amendments in a conference, speaking to you as a journalist, watching that process at Labor Party conferences. You'd have to go outside and slap your face a bit to stay awake. but there were real things happening behind the scenes, weren't there? I mean, it was about outcomes. And as you were describing this process at Bogor, I'm thinking, well, thank God you had all that training in those Labor conferences.
That's right, yeah. That's right, running around with amendments, trying to get groups together to support stuff. And of course, what would happen? You see, the way I designed the APEC leaders meeting, it was without officials. You see, because nowhere in the world were heads of government, presidents and prime ministers just bundled together without advisors. Nowhere. And of course, you know, if you can get them together and make them do things, you can make decisions, you see. And of course, the officials were horrified by all this. You know. I mean, the world is full of Humphrey Applebys, you know. I had to, and of course, what would happen, as the debate went on, some of these heads of government would run out of notes they'd been given. So they'd say to me, what do I say next? So I'd write their note, you know. I'd say, look, you can make these points, you know. Anyway, cut a long story short, the Bogor Declaration, we got up. And at the first APEC meeting, I had to introduce Jiang Zemin, the Chinese president, to Bill Clinton, and they were really, really off.
In other words, they hadn't met.
Yeah, well, they'd only had a brief meeting in Washington, but there'd been no real meeting, right? And, of course, Bill didn't want to be looked like to his audience. He was embracing China and all of that. Anyway, at the Bogor meeting, at the end of it, I got Jiang Zemin doing the karaoke and I got Clinton on the clarinet, you know. So it was a great success.
But then you in the vernacular, had the shits with Clinton by Osaka when he didn't turn up.
Yeah, that's right. He didn't turn up. He had, the Republicans wouldn't pass the budget. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And he said he had to be there to sign it. I said, well, you don't have to be there, Bill. I said, Bill, don't give me that. If you don't want to come, tell me, you know. Anyway, so he sent Al Gore. So I gave Al Gore a real roasting for Clinton not coming. Al Gore said, Prime Minister, he said, you make me feel like a skunk at the party.
And I'd picked up separately years later a book called The Clinton Tapes, which actually was based on years of secret conversations that went on at Clinton's request with an American historian named Taylor Branch. That's right. And they would have these secret meetings in Clinton's private quarters at the White House for years. And Clinton's idea was that every few weeks he'd catch up with Taylor Branch so that the record that Branch was recording would reflect Clinton's thoughts and explanations at the time. So as a record of contemporary history, it was fascinating. But as I'm reading through this, suddenly here is this account of Clinton to Taylor Branch saying, oh, Al Gore tells me that I got the rounds of the table in Osaka. He said Paul Keating, and who was the Japanese Prime Minister by then?
Osakawa.
Osakawa. Very upset.
No, Murayama by then. Murayama, yeah.
So Gore reported faithfully that
because the Americans.
You said, listen, I'm in the middle of a bloody industrial strike, a waterfront strike in Australia.
Yeah, I had a waterfront strike in the Pilbara, and I went there to keep the thing. I said, you guys are hard to help. You know, we set up all you, we put the ball on the tee for you. You've only got to do a swing, and you leave the club at home. You know. And of course, they always get spoken to so deferentially, the Americans, you know. So I thought, look, I'm fed up with this. So I got stuck right into them, you know. And that's what he said. You make me feel like a skunk at the party.
I'm going to jump on from foreign policy and come to Mabo. The thing about Mabo that I think, apart from the import of what the Mabo ruling was and what native title legislation became. But when you talk about good policy being good politics, here you were in 1992 trying to win an election that everybody regarded as unwinnable for Labor, because you had that enormous gap to make up. Mm. A And here you are going up and down, up and down, up and down through 1992. One Nation was stalling. It wasn't really working the way it was supposed to. Some things were going right, some things were going wrong. You were working John Hewson over on the GST and various other things. But nonetheless, by November, with an election just 3 months away, you were behind and still looked like you were had a huge uphill battle. So the Mabo High Court ruling has been made, and in November you decide to go out and make the Redfern speech.
Yeah.
You really nailed your flag to the mast, didn't you? That you were going to you were going to drive through Mabo regardless.
Yeah.
There were no votes in it.
The blacks were always sold out, always sold out. And I was never going to sell them out. And it was a year of Indigenous people. We were celebrating it, and the event was in Redfern Park in Sydney. And I used to say to my office, we'll never do any good with the blacks until we own up to it all, you know, until we say, instead of all the swept the stuff, the tricky words and swept under the carpet. And so, you know, when I made that speech, I said, we brought the diseases and the alcohol. We took the children from their mothers. We did the murders, you know. And of course, all the right wing hated it, you know. The Libs hated it. You know, all those Lib think tanks hated it. You know, Geoffrey Blainey hated it, you know, all these people. But the country had to come clean, you know. To wash away the stain, we had to at least acknowledge the dispossession and our brutality in doing it. So you're correct. When I made that, my party thought I had committed a major problem, political problem, because it was 3 months before the poll. I mean, no one had ever got into this stuff before. But I mean,
Gough had.
But
and in fairness, I mean, Gough started the process with land rights legislation for the Northern Territory, which was still in train when Malcolm Fraser came into office, and Fraser passed it through.
Yeah, yeah. And I acknowledged that the other night in Sydney, but no one explicitly took these issues to the public in this way, right? And I thought we just had to sort of try and wash away the stain and come clean about it, and then pursue the opportunity of native title in the event I did win the election in March 1993. As it turned out, I did, and we then, through 93, then legislated the Native Title Act. And of course, as a consequence, Aboriginal Australia will own over half the continent, over half of the land mass of Australia will be owned by the Aboriginal people as a consequence of the Native Title Act. But the Native Title Act can't own this title under this building. The Native Title Act was never going to allow all of the land alienated from the Aboriginal people by land grants by state land managers since 1788. So they were, the Aboriginal community of Australia were never going to get this land back. So therefore, the Native Title Act could only go so far. And I wanted to go further, so the Redfern speech was actually about fessing up to the dispossession and our brutality and our thoughtlessness in doing it, you know.
You then took up the majority of 1993 personally negotiating the Mabo process. Yeah. And it's fascinating to look back through the newspaper archive, kindly supplied by this man. And I might add, there's plenty of stories in that archive that at the time I don't think he would have liked.
No.
So
it's a full thing.
I was pleased to see that it wasn't all that selective. But 93 was also a crucial year for you. There were all kinds of fire fronts, not least that the 93 budget. There were storm fronts developing, even though it was the first year of your next term. You took up about 8 months. Through that negotiating process. Now, what I'm coming to is this. Don Watson wrote in Recollections of a Bleeding Heart that you had this capacity that when you took up an issue, when you were convinced of an issue,
that you brought almost a religious force to it. And there was that sense about it with Mabo and Native Title. And I came to the conclusion, and you tell me I'm wrong, because I couldn't remember a time when you had ever spoken passionately about Aboriginal issues, that you must have become convinced about it at that time and taken it up.
Yeah, now, well, you see, it's a bit like these. I mean, I don't think in Lincoln's presidency, his major issue was not slavery. I mean, what had happened, the Civil War had overtaken him, and the issue of slavery had become the central matter in that period of American federal history. In the early 1990s, after the Labor Party had decided in Bob's years not to do land rights, the thing was off the agenda. But the Native Title Act, you see, the problem about legislated land rights, as you correctly say, Gough brought in the Northern Territory Land Rights Act, and Malcolm Fraser promulgated it, right? But the land was never ours to give. The land unalienated from the Crown was never the Commonwealth Parliament's land to give. What was important about the Native Title Act, the High Court said that an ancient native title had survived the Act of Sovereignty in 1788 and was to be recognised by the common law. Now, no one knew what the title was, who could get it, who was entitled to it, or how it would be protected. All they said was, by the way, there's an ancient title here which has survived sovereignty. That meant that all the land unalienated from the Crown was capable of being claimed by Aboriginal people, provided they had a continuing association with it and that they maintained a cultural tradition on the land. And that's now, of course, before, under the Native Title Act, they now secure titles
opportunity.
So I could see there was a qualitative difference in land rights via a Native Title Act, which had an authenticity and truth about it that legislated land rights could never have. So I thought, I'm not going to be the guy who kicks this under the table. You know, I could have said, okay, High Court, you want to be clever? You make all the case law. You say what the title is. You say who can get the title. You say how you can protect it. And you had to protect it from Richard Court in Western Australia and Wayne Goss in Queensland, who wanted to wipe it all out. You know? So I had to stop the states wiping it out. So I had to move fast through 1993. And of course, there was no one to negotiate with the Aboriginal community. There was no parliament of the Aboriginal community. There was just the land.
Well, there was not one nation. There were many nations.
Yeah, many nations. There was, you know, so there was just the land councils, and that was it. So what I encouraged the Aboriginal community was come together as a group, and I brought them into the cabinet process, and they were there the better part of 8 months negotiating with the cabinet and with the mining industry and with the pastoral industries to try and deal with all of the problems of land grants that are issued illegally since 1975 when the Racial Discrimination Act came in, and how we would then validate all those mines in the Pilbara and at the same time give the Aborigines their land. And of course it could never be done by an Aboriginal Affairs Minister. It had to be done by the Prime Minister. So I had to start with a clean sheet of paper, this massive body of Aboriginal, of cultural and corporate law had to be developed from the first note, the first words, you know. So it took 8 months, and we finally got it through the Senate just before Christmas 1993. Mm.
But I want to go back to the very start of the influence of Indigenous Australians for you.
Yeah, well, it started for me, the film Jeddah, which some people here may know about.
Some of us are old enough.
It was made about 1955, and I saw it when I was, I was 11 years of age, and it had a huge effect on me. I remember walking home from the Hoyt Cinema in Bankstown, sort of haunted by the thing, you know. And that's when I really understood this was their country, not ours, you know. That thing drove it home to me. And then my father and I used to go to the boxing at Sydney Stadium, the old Sydney Stadium, Dave Sands and these guys, Aboriginal boxers, and the Jimmy Sharman troupe out at the Royal Easter Show. And invariably Aboriginal boxers were getting their head beaten in, you know, for pennies, you know. I was very conscious that they took the butt end. You know, they had to do this awful work to earn a living, and they lived in poverty in Redfern. And I used to go to Redfern quite a bit. So I developed a really soft spot for Aboriginal Australia. I really knew, and the other thing, it became clear in my parliamentary years that if we never came to terms with them, we'd never really be here properly, you know. If we didn't have a real point of reconciliation, we could never say we're all home together. You know, we'd always be interlopers in the place.
Tell me about the impact of Kim Beazley Sr.'s speech in the Parliament.
Yeah, well, Kim Beazley Sr., we used to call him the student prince. He had so many degrees. He said, oh, I never do the course, I just sit the exams. He was brilliant. Anyway, he made a speech one night about Aboriginal malnutrition, I remember this. And Bill Wentworth, it was Bill McMahon's Minister for Aboriginal Affairs.
And I think he might have been the first.
The first
Aboriginal Affairs Minister.
Yeah. He was Minister for Aboriginal Affairs. Anyway, Kim made this speech. He was a fantastic speaker. He made this speech. Anyway, at the end of it, Bill Wentworth got up and moved that the House adjourn for 15 minutes to recompose itself. I mean, so powerful was the speech. The minister, it's an opposition speech, the minister proposes to the speaker that the House adjourn for 15 minutes to recompose itself. That's how good he was, you know. So I had those influences on me, you know.
I'm really surprised. Bob Hawke, during his prime ministership, had one crack at raising as an issue the idea of a treaty between the Commonwealth and Aborigines and Aboriginal people, and it didn't go very far. Gerry Hand was his minister. It did not go very far at all. I was on the trail with him through Northern Australia when he was proposing it, and then it just disappeared. Yeah. And suddenly you're talking about it now.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, I think, look, here we are now. We're talking about a constitutional amendment, an amendment to the Australian Constitution, which says something about discrimination, you know, for Aboriginal people. Well, if you've been here for 40,000 years, would you be happy with a note in our constitution written by, you know, all those single traders, wool brokers, and you know, bunyip lawyers in 1900? You know, I mean, would you be happy with that? So I think what we should do, we should have a treaty. I mean, we should deal with the Aboriginal people as a nation and say, look, we did the disposition, we own up to it, we want to make it good. Let's set the story right. Let's get a treaty between us, you know? And then you can do the amendment. Then you can do the amendment. Then the amendment's just in a trifle, you know. But the idea now that Aboriginal people have got to say, oh, well, you know, they're trying to negotiate with Abbott, you know, and then trying to negotiate with, to get a few words in there, I mean, you know, weak.
So what force would a treaty have? Would it be symbolic? Would the value be primarily symbolic? I mean, New Zealand's history, of course, involved the Waitangi Treaty, but the Maoris were a single nation. There was a negotiation that could be conducted between leaderships.
Sure.
That certainly wasn't the case before Mabo.
Yeah.
It still really, in a sense, is not the case. I mean, you were able to get a group of Aboriginal leaders around you from Arbo.
Yeah.
But what force would a treaty have in Australia?
Well, look, the New Zealand identity is stronger as a consequence of their acceptance of the Maori and taking the symbols, the music, the culture of the Maori into, if you like, white European New Zealand's culture. New Zealand's done this much better than we've ever done it, this. And Australia will be stronger and better when we take in much larger measure the identity of Aboriginal Australia into the Australian identity, when we have a composite identity with them.
Okay.
And therefore, where do you start? Where do you start in that? You start by some basis of recognition. And the basis of recognition, I think, is a treaty late in the peace, but still symbolically so centrally important.
Well, that'll be an interesting one for Malcolm Turnbull's right-wing bloc.
Yeah, well...
When he's talking to them about the Republic as
well. Well, you know what their policy was, you know, the Libs. Their policy was assimilation. I mean, they took the children from their mothers to marry into the white society so the Aboriginal race would disappear. That was the policy, you know. I mean, look, I don't know about the Libs, but if you scratch them, there's a whole lot of assimilationists under there. You know, I saw one of them on television recently saying the same things, you know. I mean, we will be a stronger country when we do the right thing about Aboriginal Australia and we take on more of the identity. We'll be a stronger, not just a European enclave in Asia, but an identity which takes part of the identity of the original Australians. We'll be a stronger people.
Okay, I'm going to come back quickly to the Republic, but most particularly I'm interested to talk about the Malcolm Turnbull today and the Malcolm Turnbull you got to know through the Republican process in the 90s. You've, I think, kept, as he's a great note taker and keeper, which periodically has made for very interesting reading through this process we've gone through. And you've kept notes of your meetings with Malcolm Turnbull through that process.
Yeah, yeah.
How passionate was he about Australia becoming a republic in those days?
Yeah.
How good was he politically then?
Well, very passionate.
And how good is he now?
Well, very passionate he was then and very sensible, because essentially what we recommended was Australia should become a republic and that the president was appointed by both houses of parliament. And that was the offer I made the Liberal Party. And he chaired the report, which included, as I said, Nick Greiner and Maurice Payne and people like that. Because, and so therefore, not only was he passionate about it, but he adopted what I believe is the right model, you see. And when Howard defeated, through his chicanery, defeated the Republican referendum, it went down this question about whether the president should be properly elected at large or appointed by both houses of parliament. But the great trouble is, and Malcolm saw the right answer here, he saw the right answer. The problem is, if you have one person in the system elected by the whole nation, all the power devolves to that person away from the parliamentary government, away from the cabinet and the prime minister. And I'm not sure Australians want that to happen. A representative system of government, a representative democracy, a representative system of government, the diffusion of power is safe, strong and better. You don't want someone at the top of the system hearing voices like John Kerr heard voices, right? you don't want that, you know. But you give a president office by popular election, they will hear voices and the system will change.
So my impression and my memory of that referendum process run by John Howard was that Howard played Turnbull off a break,
yeah, of course,
politically.
Yeah. I actually told Malcolm not to deal with him. I said he'll just suck you in. But But the Republican movement, of which Malcolm was then the main spokesperson, was already running at such a pace that they couldn't resist doing it, you know.
So my question is, how much better a politician is Malcolm Turnbull today than he was then?
I think Malcolm Turnbull's defeat at the hands of Abbott 5 or so years ago has made Malcolm reassess himself, rethink the role of public life and the leader. And I think it's fair to say Malcolm Turnbull will be a better leader today than he would have been 5 years ago as a consequence of that.
Were you surprised by the extent of to which the nation seems to have embraced him since he's become Prime Minister?
Oh, well, Kerry, the bar is so low, like you've only got to put... I mean, these days, if you can string five coherent sentences together, not make a mistake a day or a week, and have some cultural sensitivities, you know, you're going to be approved of, you know. And of course, in my day, you know, like in those 4 years, you know, I was doing things like native title, you know, setting up national superannuation, you know, the APEC leaders meeting, you know, one great big trick after another. These days, you've only got to handle a press conference, you know, or be polite at the door.
You could argue whether the press conferences were handled, but that's another issue. So, what would Malcolm Turnbull's biggest challenge, what do you think his biggest challenge is going to be in this next period?
Shifting that block of party of his from the right to the centre. That's the great challenge. I mean, you know, trying to de-louse the thing of all of that obscurantism it has, you know. And I think it's an objective test for him, because you can't be the reasonable person running fundamentally an unreasonable party, you know. We want the reasonable person, and Malcolm is a reasonable person, running a party which becomes reasonable.
Well, speaking of reason, I'm going to make this little bridge across to your arts policy, because it's one thing that we haven't talked about tonight, but I know it was very important to you, and that was, I think it was called Creative Nation, and that was 1994, a very substantial part of which you pretty much wrote yourself. But when you talk about the arts and the importance of the arts, and you talk about the tension between passion and reason, tell me about it.
Well, look, this is the great thing between, you know, science and fantasy, passion. You know, not everything which is deductible is important in life. You know, most of the society we have today, our societal norms have come from the inner selves, you know, from the inner beliefs, the inner feelings. So I always thought that I'm as rational, I think, as most people in public life. You know, I sort of accept all the Enlightenment precepts, but I think where passion and reason rub against each other, when it does, you end up with a bigger result, you know. And so I tried to pursue that through my public life, whereas, and you know, whereas it helps to have the mad gene, and I have the mad gene. There's no doubt about that. You
know. When did you first recognise that the you crazy had the mad gene?
Well, when you take the risks, you take the risks, you know, and burn up the road, you know. I used to say about the caucus, you know why I love that road runner? He runs so fast, there's no road left behind for the others, you know. He's burned it all, the bitumen up, you know. So I always believed in spending the capital and pushing the changes through, you know. But you have to have imagination. I mean, always the two central things in leadership are imagination first and courage second. the fantasy and the power to push it all through and make it happen. And without the fantasy, without the dreaming, to be just a deducer is way not good enough, I think. You know, so I've always believed this, and it's, you know, it's the, it's like Immanuel Kant said, it's the also the inner self, you know, the inner command, the inner command, and
the conversation, the on-site service, the conversation wrote acknowledging the 20th anniversary of Creative Nation, which they described as the first document of its kind produced by an Australian government.
Yeah.
What do you think that said about Australia in 1994?
Well, that's the point. You see, people think that the arts are not central to the country. I think the arts are central to the country. They speak to us about ourselves. They're a mirror to ourselves, and they lift ourselves. You mean, you look at the Brisbane Cultural Centre now. I mean, people go to Brisbane for the arts. I mean, you know, you set up Mona in Tasmania and people are going to Mona.
Well,
I mean,
the public... It sort of turned the economy around.
And I know, exactly. That's why the arts are central. And you see, you can never get... And the reason why a lot of people in public life, they've never had an emotional connection with the arts. They've never had the hit to the heart, you know. And as a consequence, they've never understood the central... You know, how... I mean, if your brain, let's make a synonym or analogy. If your brain is an electric motor, what makes it work is the electricity. You know, you want the electricity to start the locomotion of thinking and imagination, right? Where does the imagination come from? Where is the electricity? The arts provide that. You know, in my case, music. I think music's the highest form of the arts, you know. Other people may disagree. But the music the music always turned me on, you know. It always got me going, you know. And, you know, every morning I do, like I get up in Canberra about 6, I do the papers by about 7:45. I'd bring Russell or Gingell up and I'd do a note or two. I'd say, we better get a note up on this and a note up on that. And about 8:15, I'd sit down and I might listen to, you know, Yasha Heifetz doing Brooke's Scottish Fantasy or the Brooke Violin Concerto, you know. And then I get a bit wistful about that and I think, oh, I need a bigger hit, you know. And then I might get on the Strauss, one of the Strauss tone poems like Zarathustra, you know. And I'd say, what time is it? 9 o'clock. Well, no, look, I'll put on Bruckner's Fifth Symphony. And I get a super hit, you know. And of course... And you go down the office and it just brings everything in proportion. Not only are you pumped high where you can do everything, you know, but more than that, it puts it all into proper perspective, you know. Whereas my colleagues, they'd go home with the cabinet submissions, you know, and then they'd read the papers and listen to AM, and they'd read it up, you know. And I'd walk in and I'd have the stuff going through my head, you know, I'd still be conducting, you know. Right. I remember Michelle Grattan one day for a budget. I came up and she used to wear the specs, you know, she'd put the specs back on. Yeah, you know, Treasurer, what were you doing this morning? Were you doing the budget? I said, well, as a matter of fact, I said, I'll tell you what I did this morning, Michelle. I listened to Richard Strauss's last 4 songs and the 3 songs by Korngold. She said, what? Didn't understand it at all. And of course, you know, I walked in calm as a cucumber, you know. I mean, I wasn't going to worry about the budget papers. I had all that in my head, you know.
Still on the arts, still on music, Geoffrey Tozer, who you described the first time you laid eyes on him at your son's Christmas concert at his school.
Yeah.
You described him as this lumpy guy in an ill-fitting suit who shambled onto a stage to play a piece of work that you thought could only be played well by a handful of people around the world, and you were wincing in anticipation of what an embarrassing moment it was going to be.
Yeah, it was the Christmas party and he was the music teacher, and I thought, oh well, I've got to sit through this, you know. And here's this guy, he does Liszt's Mephisto Waltz. There'd be like no one else in Australia could play it fundamentally that like that. And so here's a guy playing like Emil Galels or somebody like that, or Busoni, you know. I thought, who is this guy? Anyway, he was getting $9,000 a year teaching at my son's high school. That's the Australian arts for you. You know, starved by the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra, starved by the Sydney Symphony Orchestra. You know, snobs, you know, they have to always book Europeans, you know. So Geoffrey was playing, he played with Sir Colin Davis and the London Symphony Orchestra when he was 12. And as a consequence of this, I introduced the Artist Creative Fellowship Program, where I took artists in mid-career and we paid them, in today's dollars, about $150,000 to $160,000, in today's dollars, for 3 and 5 years. And on that, Geoffrey then recorded 37 discs with Chandos in Britain, which was the most out there classical recording label. And the first one, which where he recorded for the first time the three piano concertos of Nikolai Metner, who was Rachmaninoff's master, won the French Gold Prize and nearly won the American Grammys, and were beaten by Yo-Yo Ma, the American cellist, by one place. You know, that's how good he was.
So not only did you do that, but you were in London on one occasion and you decided that he needed a bit of a boost for his international career. So you went to the guy who headed Chandos.
Yeah.
And you said, have I got a pianist for you?
Yeah, he was down in Colchester. And I went down to see him in the embassy car. And he said, what would somebody like you want with somebody like me? He said, I said, well, as a matter of fact, there's this pianist in Australia I think is playing at the level of Galels, you know. And I said, I've got a tape here. And he said, look, I'll tell you what, people make up tapes, they play a great work, it can sound marvellous, and they break down and then they replay it and they put it together. He said, he sounds marvellous, send him over. So I sent Geoffrey over
on
the next...
You didn't just send him over, didn't you? Didn't you actually pay the tickets for him to go?
I paid his fare and I underwrote the first...
I don't mean you, the government, I mean
no,
you
me,
personally.
No, me, myself, yeah. I paid his fare and I underwrote the first recordings with Chandos, the ones that won the Gold Prize, with the London Symphony Orchestra. And Geoffrey never looked back, you know. I mean, Geoffrey's recordings of the Metners are the world standard today, and the Busoni the same, you know, they're the world standard. And, you know, Geoffrey died at 51, basically of a broken heart, basically because the Australian musical establishment didn't want to deal with him, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're going to come to the last sort of 18, the last year, really, of your Prime Ministership. And I think to a degree that, to me, a pattern emerges in the book about part of the explanation as to why you lost in 96, which was that you had become so immersed in the policy, but so bored by the politics. Yeah. Not so much that you took your eye off the politics,
yeah,
but that it mattered less.
Yeah.
And
well,
that,
not really.
And that,
not
that
really,
was,
yeah.
And that was fundamentally, yeah, a mistake.
Well, it really wasn't true. I mean, look, I had to beat three opposition leaders in 3 years. I beat Hewson in 96.
93,
I'm sorry, and in he remained leader in 94. I knocked him off in 94, then I got Curly Downer after that. Right?
That was an aberration.
Yeah, and yeah, but it was an aberration because I pounded him into the ground like a tent snake.
Well, my memory, Paul, is that he did a lot of that for himself.
Yeah, well, he wasn't. I'll admit he wasn't good. And then, of course, we got little Johnny back, you know, after I made a mess of him in the 87 election with his unfunded tax cuts. And so I've got to now knock off a third one in 3 years, and this was hard to do. If I'd have had a four-year parliament, I would have trodden on him like I did in 87. I just didn't have the time to tear him in bits apart, you know. I didn't have the time to tug him apart. But I nearly did. I got within 4 percentage points in the 96 poll. I got within 4 percentage points. At one point, I had 2% to change. But the Labor Party died on me. The Federal Office died on me. Wouldn't fight. Wouldn't fund the program. Wouldn't fund the ads. And as a consequence, he slid through. So it's not true that it's not true.
He didn't slide through, Paul. It was a landslide.
No. I'm talking about in policy or media terms. He slid through. He slid through because, and we had, of course, that Craven press gallery. That shockingly low rent bunch in the Canberra press gallery.
You thought they were pretty good in your Treasury years, and I remember in the Placido Domingo speech you praised them for coming on the journey with you.
Yeah, I know, but they were sellouts. You know, in the end, they were a bunch.
They weren't a part of the government. They're supposed to be independent.
Yeah, I know, but here was I trying to change the way the whole country functioned, its economy, its external orientation, massive changes all the way through, you know, whether you're talking about superannuation or native title. But being the bunch of old tarts they are, they could not resist.
Eh? We're tarts.
They couldn't resist, oh, look, Labor's been there 13 years and we're tired of Keating pushing us around and he doesn't like us as much anymore, so we'll go for little Johnny Howard. By the way, he's not a suburban racist. He's not a suburban racist sitting behind a little white picket fence. He's a new made person, you know. And by the way, he believes in Medicare. And by the way, he believes in Labor's industrial relations policy. You know, and by the way, he believes in superannuation. And by the way, and I said, look, if John Howard says he's a wombat, is he a wombat or is he John Howard? You know, I mean, you're going to say, are you going to write in the Financial Review, the leader of the opposition, Mr. Wombat, said to, you know, I mean, you know, but that's the way they were. They were going to give Johnny a go, come what may, you know. And, you know, I had 13 years out of them, 13 years with them. But, you know, they reverted to type in the end.
We're getting close to time, which is a funny thing to be saying at the end of 90 minutes. I used to say that on 7:30 after 7 or 8. But here's another conundrum for me, that on the one hand you say, actually, I quite liked John Howard and I accepted the fact that his commitment to public service was genuine and I respected him for it.
Yeah.
And then, not quite in the next breath, but not long after that, you're just as capable of saying he was a little suburban white picket fence racist.
Yeah, well, the thing is, well, he said, you know, we've got to think about Asian migration. Well, I mean, you know, I think we're overdoing it with Asian migration. Of course, all the newspapers, oh, no, he really didn't mean that in 1987. He's now turned over a new leaf. Look.
But did you like him or not?
Yeah,
did
look,
you respect
look,
him
I,
or not?
What I liked about Howard was he had to work his way through the Liberal Party. He actually believed the things he believed. You know, I mean, none of the things I believe, mostly. Some things I believe in common with him. But I had a view of Australia as a non-derivative, open, expansive society, integrating itself. I always thought Australia could be an open, competitive, cosmopolitan republic integrated into Asia. John never believed any of that, you know? He wanted the old derivative model. You go back to the United States or you go back to Britain, Whitehall, you know. So he and I never agreed on the policy, but he was a battler. He was a parliamentary battler, you know. And I had more time for him than I did for a lot of other Liberal leaders. I reckon never had his commitment to public service. I mean, I don't doubt at all Howard's commitment to public service. It just was of a Menzian Australia. A small Australia, you know, a constrained little diminutive Australia.
But you respected him nonetheless.
I'm going to
bring you back.
Perhaps kinder than I should have been, but, you know, kindness has a place.
I'm going to quickly bring you back to that business before about politics and policy, and that you had become extremely engrossed, very personally engrossed, more than your average Prime Minister, I would suggest, in a lot of those policy areas. I mean, the stories of how Don Watson and you would be faxing to each other when you're at the lodge at 1 o'clock in the morning writing the arts policy.
Yeah.
So it was Don Watson who decides, the officer's kind of in despair. He decides they've got to get Don Russell back, who's in the meantime gone to Washington to be the ambassador.
Yeah.
And as Paul Kelly wrote in March of Patriots, when Don Russell arrives back, he, quote, found Keating hemmed in and isolated. He was absorbed in the issues close to his heart. The Republic, Mabo, the arts and foreign affairs, the government got little credit for growth in the economy or for its array of social welfare programs. And I said to you, did Russell say those things to you at the time? And you said, some he did.
Yeah, he did.
He said some of those things.
He said some of those things. But you see, look, you only get a chance of doing a republic once. You only get a chance of doing native title once. You know, you only get a chance to say the right things about the dispossession, you know, once. You get a chance to build a great piece of political architecture in the Pacific once. You know, I don't know, I didn't know how long the Labor government 1983, then by 1996 would go, but I sure as hell wasn't going to lay down on the way, you know. I wanted to push the boundary all the way, and the idea that I was going to become a little right-wing figure, you know, offering, you know, tax cuts here and a bit of comfort there and a little bit of saying, oh, I think we've overdone Asian immigration there, or, you know. No, I couldn't do that. I had to go for the big ones. You've got to hit them into the stand every time.
We leave them there or we leave them laughing? Leave them laughing? I'm going to ask you again to tell the story. It's one of my favourite stories from the book, which I had never heard from you before. And in there is Paul Keating just admitting to a very slight glimmer of self-doubt. And it was in November of 92, again, at the same time as you're doing the Redfern speech, you're thinking, it suddenly occurs to you that Australians have worked out that they can get rid of you and have John Hewson without the GST.
Yeah.
And you didn't really consult anyone other than, I think, Stephen Smith, now who subsequently became a defence minister, but he was your political advisor. You sounded your idea out to him and he said, oh, for God's sake, don't do that, Paul, that'd be a disaster. So pick the story up. What exactly was the plan?
Well, so what happened? So Hewson's on a roll with the GST, you know, and of course the press gallery giving him a free ride, you know, and he's a new made person. He's not really a nasty politician like the rest of us. He's really a pure economic guy and he's got fight back, you know, Acme fight back, and he's going to give us the GST. So in the middle of all this, and I'm behind at this stage, so I said at one question time, well, I'll tell you this. If you win the election, we, the Labor Party in opposition, will pass the GST. Because if you get a mandate for the GST, we'll accept that mandate and pass it in the Senate. And of course, the Libs just were ecstatic.
They couldn't get out of the parliament quick enough to start the party.
I know, they couldn't get out. And of course, our crowd said, oh, we've lost the election. He's killed us in one sentence, you know. And I thought to myself, God, maybe I have. You know, maybe I have. I mean, maybe I've just judged this wrong, because I want to say to the public, you want to take the nasty guy with the Thatcherite policy, you get the GST. You can't have him without the GST, because we'll pass it. Because they thought, oh, we'll be tired of that, Mr. Keating, the Labor Party. We can take that nice, clean Dr. Hewson, and we won't have the GST because the Labor Party will down it in the Senate, right? So I'm saying, no, we won't. We'll pass it in the Senate, right? So, of course, my crowd were just completely dispirited. So of course, I thought to myself, God, what do I do here? Because, you know, the parliamentary Labor Party had just virtually folded its tent. And so I ring up Lynham to do the 7:30 report on the ABC, and Lynham's calling us to do an interview. And I thought, I'll do this, but I have to do this really well. Now, I used to do acupuncture every Friday night in Canberra, every Friday night. And I had this bloke, he was a stiff upper lip army officer of all people from Duntroon, who used to...
I didn't realise acupuncture was on Duntroon's
anyway,
agenda.
No, he was great. He had me off pat. He could put me to sleep in 30 seconds. Needle, places you put the needle, it relaxes you, renews you and makes you brighter. the karma. So I ring him up, I said, look, what about coming over the lodge tonight? I think I might need a dose of the acupuncture, you see. So he comes to the lodge and I tell him what the problem is. Anyway, he takes me upstairs and he puts it there. Sure enough, out I go for sleep. I said, don't wake me quickly. Give me half an hour at least. So of course I wake up, well, I'm as calm can be. You know, I'm full of confidence about the whole thing, you know. So of course I go down to the ABC and there's Lynham. He used to have a twitch Lynham. He was twitching up there and he's ready to sort of tear me to pieces. And I, here it is, I've just belted the ball and right across the stadium, you know, with all of the confidence in the world, you know. And that television opportunity, that television appearance got me out of that hole and buried Hewson. You know, buried Hewson. So it just shows you, you've got to take the risks. You've got to be an instinct player, take the risk.
And
you've got but, to you need it, but you need accurate puncturists beside you. Thanks, mate.
Thanks indeed. Great to see you.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.